Radio.
Biking all the way from Colorado and then pioneering this new approach. And I mean, this was like a major thing for us. So in my mind, the magnitude, the adventure and the difficulty was really in the whole package.
Hey y'all, I'm Ryan Devlin and welcome to the Struggle Climbing Show, where I talk with elite climbers about their struggles and breakthroughs in training, nutrition, tactics, and mental game. And today we're reconnecting with one of the greatest climbers, adventurers, and environmental advocates of our time, Tommy Caldwell. Now in this special Earth Day episode here, Tommy takes us along for the ride, the bike ride, that is, that he and his buddy Alex Honnold did this past year as they pedaled from Colorado to Alaska. Yes, on bikes, from Colorado to Alaska, with the assist of a sailboat somewhere in there as well. Climbing some of the most badass stuff along the way and culminating in their ascent of the Devil's Thumb in the Tongass National Forest, this conversation explores the limits of human endurance, high-risk climbing objectives, environmental advocacy, and how we can all invite a little bit more adventure into our lives. And speaking of inviting a little more adventure into our lives, I invited a lot more adventure into my life this past weekend as I competed in a climbing competition called RIAD, which stands for Red in a Day. It's kind of based on NIAD, of course, Nose in a Day. And so that's climbing 31 pitches in a day here at the Red River Gorge. It was put on by the Red River Gorge Climbing Coalition, which is just a great nonprofit here. This was just an awesome break from being very tunnel vision, a little bit single-minded on my project. I'm still working on that 13A, and I'm really, really close on it. If I can get some cool weather here this spring, I think it has a great chance of going down. But to just focus on climbing 31 pitches in a day was a total diversion. I climbed with past guest Dr. Thomas Cunningham, and I gotta say, I'm really proud of how this came out. Not only did we finish, but we finished in style. We did 31 pitches in 6.5 hours, and then jumped in a cold river and celebrated and high-fived and had some slices of pizza over at Miguel's. It was a really cool way, I think, for me at least, to remind myself that climbing offers so much fulfillment, whether you're pushing grades or, like I was, just out with a friend having a blast on some moderates. So I hope you are having a blast on whatever you're working on this spring. I'm looking at my Coros watch right now. It says I still have 90 hours to go before full recovery. So I put my body through the ringer, but I'm really happy for it, and I'll be getting back on the project soon. This episode is supported by Scarpa, and while it's true that I am totally obsessed with their climbing shoes, I want to talk for a second about their ridiculously awesome trail runners, you guys. I've been working some trail runs in about once or twice a week for a little while now. Nothing too crazy. I'm not like a pro runner. And I'm telling you, for the first time ever in my life as a runner, my knees and my shins are not hurting, and no doubt that's because of what I got on my feet. First of all, the Spin Planets by Scarpa are the lightest shoes that I've ever tied into. They are clouds, and they just grip to that dirt and rock like an absolute dream out on those trails. They also have serious sustainability chops, y'all. They're made from a significant amount of recycled content, which I love. And then the Golden Gates by Scarpa, I need to mention as well. I've got a pair of those, and they've got a little bit more cushion on them, so they're a great transition shoe between trail, gravel, and pavement. So, you know, like if you run on a variety of surfaces, check out the Golden Gates. They are so comfy. They're so light. You can shop the entire collection over at Scarpa.com. Scarpa, no place too far. And lastly here, as this is the Earth Day episode, I just want to shout out the Honnold Foundation here, which I've partnered with to make the struggle carbon neutral since my very first episode. And I just got to say, if you're listening to this episode right now, I'm pretty sure that you love nature and you love spending a lot of time out in it. And the work that the Honnold Foundation does is really impactful, y'all. They partner with marginalized communities to expand equitable solar energy access. What does that mean? Well, here's an example. They're funding a project right now for a fishing community in the Anambas Islands, which makes possible a solar-powered recycling center. How eco is that? A solar-powered recycling center, which not only cleans up their land and their water there in the archipelago, but it also will generate additional income for residents by offering cash payments for waste. That's just one of the really cool projects that Honnold Foundation supports through their grants. I love giving them my money every month. And if you have a few bucks to spare, I just cannot think of a better place to put that money to work on behalf of this world that we love so much. So you can learn more about that Anambas project and all of their other projects over at honnoldfoundation.org. Thank you for supporting them if you can. All right, let's get ready to log some serious mileage now on bike and rock with the one and only Tommy Caldwell. It's great to see you, first of all. The last time we chatted, I think it was like the day after you re-ruptured your Achilles.
Oh, really? Holy cow, that was probably an interesting day to chat. I should listen to that again.
It was a little bleak, if I'm being honest. Like it was a little dark at the start.
Yeah, totally. No, that was not a good moment. That was like, you know, that was a 2-year saga in the end. And that was when I re-ruptured if it's the time I'm thinking, it was like, yeah, I was sad about it.
Did you re-rupture it biking or climbing? I guess you were doing a lot of biking and maybe it was in preparation for this trip, you know, at which you weren't talking about at the time because maybe you guys were still in the idea phases. But I know you were doing a lot of biking, I guess, as part of the rehab of it. And I don't know if the re-rupture came as a result of that work or maybe it was PT work you were doing.
Yeah, it was just at the PT. I just was trying to go too hard at the PT, blew up right there.
Oh my God, dude. Well, it was a little dark because I was like, oh my God, I'm talking to my climbing hero. This is going to be amazing. And you came on and you're like, hey, I was like, what's up, dude? And you're like, oh.
Like life is grim.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's much better now. Everything's on the up and up this time. So maybe we'll bring a different vibe.
That's great. Well, no, dude, it's so good to reconnect. And I'm really psyched to talk with you about this trip that you and Alex went on. I was just out in Vegas and got to spend a day with Alex and climbed with him and then had dinner with he and Sonny. It was right before they had their second daughter.
Alice.
Yeah. Such a cutie. But this was like a great day. And we talked a little bit about it, but we didn't dive into it because I told him, like, you know, I wanted to be able to craft a show around it. So I don't know really much about this trip aside from what you all shared and what Taylor shared as well. Taylor Schaefer, who was along the ride with you guys and shooting such great stills as well as video footage. And I spent the day with Taylor as well out in Vegas because we were filming something. And so he was out there shooting with us.
Oh, cool.
Such a good dude. Love that guy. He was filming with a drone that I think you and Alex gave him.
Oh, nice. He's making use of that thing. Yeah, totally. That's great. Yeah, I mean, Taylor was like a guy. That was like one of the better luck events of the last years of my life was just like having Taylor somehow come on that trip. And he was so awesome.
So I got like these little nuggets of these adventures that you all had, but I'm excited to just start to piece it together and weave it in because this is an Earth Day episode and theme here with really what I, if I'm understanding correctly, kind of underpinned the entire adventure, which was this eye towards exploring the places that were either at risk or maybe are protected but need additional protection or awareness. And so maybe I'll just let you set the stage for it. Like, I want to talk about the adventure part of it. I want to talk about pushing the human body to the limits of endurance and all these great things that probably a lot of people are listening for. But the spirit and the provenance, if you will, of this was really along an environmental kind of line, if I'm understanding correctly.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I do that I spend a lot of time doing these days is I actually have a proper job, believe it or not. I've just been a climber my whole life, but I'm now technically employed by Patagonia as a global sports activist, which means my job is to have my eye on environmental issues that climbers can get involved in and try and get them like fired up about it. And so as part of that, I'm on a lot of calls with environmental nonprofits that Patagonia works with, one of them being the Alaska Wilderness League. And they were sort of my inside track to go into the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge a few years ago. They always come to me with these big environmental fights in Alaska, which I love Alaska. And they're like, I think that you could do some good work here to bring awareness, go to DC, talk about it, do things like that. So Tongass National Forest is one of the issues that they're constantly working on. And at one point I decided to just like look into it and see if there was good climbing there. And turns out the Devil's Thumb, which is, I mean, it's a really, really amazing mountain. It's so far off the beaten path that not that many people have heard about it, but it's like the mountain that was the formative climbing experience for John Krakauer in Into the Wild. He dedicates two chapters to going to try and climb this mountain. It's in the middle of this rainforest. It's this heavily glaciered, crevassed area. It's like, by the numbers, actually one of the most dangerous mountains in the world. But it's like so beautiful. Like if a kid draws a picture of a mountain, that's the shape they draw. You know, it's really, really cool.
Yeah. Although I've read a lot of Krakauer's writing, so surely I was exposed to it from his writing as well. But I also recall reading about or maybe watching that film on Fred Becky, because I think Fred Becky went out there and was climbing on that as well.
Yeah, he did the first ascent of the Devil's Thumb. Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Very good. So it's like you said, it's like this absolute striking feature. And so is that in Anwar? Or that's in Tongass?
It's in Tongass National Forest. And Tongass National Forest is basically almost the entire panhandle of Alaska is Tongass National Forest. And so it's a big area. But also Tongass National Forest is, you know, kind of ground zero for the logging fight. Like 70 or 80% of it was logged in the 70s and 80s. And it's this constant fight to try and figure out how to save what's left. Like, you can't just designate big national monuments politically in Alaska the same way you kind of can in the lower 48. And so the national forest, there's been so locked that they've tried to figure out like creative solutions to try and protect it. Like Clinton at one point came up with this idea to just outlaw road building called the roadless rule. And so if you can't build roads in there, it's so much harder to extract the trees. And so that gets bounced back, you know, basically based on the current administration's like Clinton designated it a monument, Trump rolled it back, I forget what Obama did with it, but Biden put the roadless rule back in place. And then there's all these other issues that go on there. But I mean, like I kind of dove deeply into the politics of what saves forests like that. And in the end, I decided that all the politics don't really matter unless there's a huge public will to want to protect it. And that's what happened in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Like enough people really cared that it's gone a long ways to helping protect the place. So I was like, my strategy should be to just raise awareness for this place, like get people knowing what it is, knowing what the issues are, and that's really going to be what saves it in the long run. So I decided to start doing that through my Patagonia work. Like I was, you know, a lot of times with these big fights, I'm like, I'll just go and I'll do a trip there and I'll go with a photographer or a video maker and we'll just do some social media content. And so that's how it kind of all started for me, learning about that place. But then I was also at this place where I'd ruptured my Achilles. I hadn't climbed for 2 years. I thought that biking would be a good way to heal. And also I was so adventure starved that I was like, I need a really big adventure. Like I haven't really climbed in 2 years. I want a really big adventure. So all those things started to come together in my mind. And I was like, I'm going to bike from my house in Colorado all the way to Alaska and then climb this mountain. And yeah, so it just seemed like it ticked so many boxes in my life.
That's such a leap for like any normal human to make. I just want to crawl inside that mindset just for a second, because wanting to draw attention to and protect a remote area makes a ton of sense. It's so striking. It's so beautiful, but we don't know it. You're a known, you know, celebrity in the climbing and adventuring world. Like, yeah, go out there, put up some gnarly stuff, get some amazing footage. But most people would like just hop on an airplane, you know, and go out and like do the thing. That's typically what happens. I mean, it's like, it sounds insane to me to say I'm going to ride my bike from Colorado to Alaska. Like, talk me through that, like, evolution of that idea. And also, you know, like, what does your wife say when you say I'm going to ride to Alaska?
I mean, like, I always sort of liked the idea of doing a long bike tour. Like, even when I was like 12 and 13 years old, I was like, I'm going to bike across the United States. You know, I just like wanted to do it. I like riding my bike. I think it's a cool way to see things. I think when you go slower through a landscape and through changing landscapes, they impact you way differently. So, you know, I'm always trying to figure out ways to be closer to nature. If you want to protect it, you want to like love it as much as you can. And there's no way like that to really like be in it, like being on a bike for a couple months. With my wife, I'd saved up, you know, 2 years of being home constantly. I think she was kind of ready to be rid of me a little bit in a way. Not really, but she, you know, she was very, very supportive, partially because it's my job, you know, it's kind of inspiring. Like, we want to teach our kids to want to figure out how to protect these places and, you know, just like dreaming big and going out and doing these things is kind of the way to do that. So although it was hard for me to be gone for 2 months on all of us, really, it there was never a question of like, should I do this? Like, when the idea started to come together, really seemed like I wanted to do it. Plus, the idea at first was just like, I was going to just do it by myself. And then another part of the plan, when I went to put together the bike ride, I just literally, what I did is I typed Devil's Thumb into Google Maps and hit the bike button on there, and it drew a line. And I was like, well, this actually takes me right by Mount Hooker in Wyoming, which is a place that I have climbed a little bit, but I wanted to climb more. And it takes me right by the Bugaboos too, which is a place I had never been that I really wanted to go. So I was like, this seems like the most incredible summer either ever. We're going to bike this whole way. And so I was going to meet up with friends in different places. But then at some point I was, you know, I was listening to this book called Wild Idea. It's like a biography about Doug Tompkins. And it was reminding me of that whole origin story of Patagonia, where they drove all the way down to Southern Argentina. And I was like, you know, doing this by myself would be great, but doing this with a friend, that's really what I want to do. Alex, I knew, had a baby on the way. I was like, there's no way he's going to be able to do this, but I called him anyways. I was like, who knows? Maybe there's a chance. And it's funny, I proposed the idea, and he's like, no, there's no way I could do this. And then like the next day, he called me back. He's like, I think he was just having serious FOMO. He's like, I really want to figure out a way to do this. And so he decided he wanted to figure it out. And once he was on the, you know, onto that idea train, the whole idea blew up and took on a life of its own. And that's how the Nat Geo film got involved, because he was supposed to do a filming project for Nat Geo in Africa, I think. And he's like, why don't you pitch this idea to them and see if they'll bite? And I did that, and they bit. And so, yeah, it went from being this very soulful like solo journey to being a full-on Nat Geo film project, which I guess in some ways I'm still mixed about, but mostly very excited about, because it meant Alex could go. It meant that our goal of raising awareness for this place is, you know, probably going to be pretty successful. They're going to make a full Nat Geo documentary film about it. So yeah, and plus we had the whole like production team of Nat Geo behind it, so the planning got really legit. And so it made it, you know, like once they're going to invest that kind of money, they want to make sure things go well.
Yeah, they did a little bit more than just Google the destination and hit the bike icon. Although it sounds like ultimately you took a similar or the same route. It's just that you had a support crew along the way.
Yeah, we needed a support crew. And actually, Nat Geo, interestingly, wasn't that interested in the bike ride at first. They're like, we really want to make this about Tongass National Forest and the Devil's Thumb. And we think the idea of just filming you biking doesn't sound all that interesting. And so Taylor got involved because we were like, I think they're going to want a little bit of footage of this. You know, it seems silly to just make it only about Tongass. So we actually kind of figured out how to fundraise for Taylor and hire him separately from Nat Geo, knowing that they were likely going to want to license the footage in the end, which they did. Like, Taylor's like a huge part of the film. He's not only took a lot of the footage and the photography, but he became a major character, and he's like writing music for the thing. And he's like, he's probably a bigger part of the film than I am in some ways.
What a cool, just like the seed of this idea and the way that it grew and evolved. And I mean, what a mega adventure. Do you all have an idea on when Nat Geo is going to release this?
It's targeted for October.
Okay. So we got to wait a little bit, but we get a little understanding of some of the experience here through this conversation. Can we explore for a second the bike ride then? And when Alex said he was in, I remember him posting before you all announced that this was happening. Like, I remember him starting to post videos or pictures of him like out on his bike. And I mean, it literally looked like he had like a bike and a helmet from like the 1990s. I mean, like, I don't know the last time. He's obviously a very strong endurance athlete. He had done the Hurt, and you guys had done the Cuddle and these kinds of things. Like, you know, you both probably have resting heart rates in the teens, but he didn't look all that experienced or comfortable on a bike. You had been doing a ton of biking. So what was the preparation time like for you all to get in shape before you pushed off from Colorado to Alaska?
Well, I mean, I actually had done some pretty big bike tours. Like, he climbed all the 14ers in California and biked between them at one point.
Yeah, he did like a Sufferfest with Cedar. That's right.
Both Sufferfest. And then he did another one in the like climbing desert towers on a bike. So he had actually done more bike touring than I had. I just kind of had this idea, and I sort of, through my Achilles injury, I had to use my bike as a way to get cardio exercise just around home. So I'd been doing a fair amount of biking. Like, I'd been going out 5 days a week and biking for like an hour or two, which got me pretty fit for it. Yeah. And then when I started to anticipate the long ride, I went out and I think I did 2 100+ mile days on my bike just to make sure I knew how to like fuel myself on calories. But we weren't bikers. I mean, like we said, I mean, like, as I started to research things, I talked to a friend who does the Colorado or the Continental Divide Trail Race every year. He's like a bike packer. And for a while, he tried to convince me that I should take that route on dirt roads, which would have been great, but it just would have added too much time. So ultimately, we didn't do it. But I got information on how to bike pack a little bit more. And so I was planning on doing it, like carrying all my own stuff. But then when it became an Agio film project, you know, we're like, a van's going to be with us. We'll just have the van carry everything and jump on our bikes. But, you know, neither of us take biking seriously. Like, you know, I'm sure bikers look at us like we look at beginner climbers that have like, you know, hexes clanking around on their harness. They're like, oh, they're doing it all wrong. They have no idea what they're doing.
but yet you rode from Colorado to Alaska, and I'm curious what just stands out from that experience, whether it was the physical struggle or perhaps not along the way. And also just in taking these back roads and kind of non-roads sometimes, based on some of the things that I saw you all share and talking to Taylor, you know, the parts of America that you saw in Canada and into Alaska that you saw that maybe stood out as well. So maybe, yeah, a couple things from the experience between point A and point B that really have stuck with you.
Yeah, I mean, first off, I don't know where Google gets its bike directions. Like, when you hit that bike button, it doesn't mean much. Like day 2 and 3, we were like in the middle of Wyoming questing on cattle trails and like forging swamps. And I'm like, who has ridden their bike here before? Like, I could not believe it. And we're on these gravel bikes and we're just getting used to them. And it was like serious mountain biking. We had sort of budgeted 100 miles a day, which was, I felt like, a little ambitious because I had only ridden 100 miles on my bike like twice in my life. And we were planning on doing it like every day. And so one really good thing is Alex is pretty smart in these ways. He's like, we are just going to keep it zone one the whole time. Like, when I'd go out for training rides, I would push hard and I'd come back blown up, like bonking. Like, I would come back from 100-mile training day and be like, I am destroyed. How am I going to do this for like 26 days straight? Once we got on our bikes, Alex was like, just go slow. We don't need to go fast. And it turns out if you just bike very slowly, I think you can just bike forever. Huh. So we figured that out pretty quickly.
And what was zone? Well, was that like a heart rate thing or conversational thing? How are you essentially setting your pace?
Yeah, I wore a heart rate monitor, and I would, you know, I tried to, I mean, I don't know if I really, like, we would keep it conversational. We would stop and eat, you know, a lot of food whenever we needed to. And I think my average heart rate, like if I go back and look at like my Coros data, was around 110 most days on the bike, and up to like 120 on like the hardest days. Like, when we were in the middle of Wyoming questing across cattle trails, my heart rate was higher those days because I felt like I was going to die for like 8 hours at a time. I mean, and then that was one thing that really stood out too. Like, I had driven through southern Wyoming on I-80 a bunch of times. And when you drive, you're kind of like, it's like a little bit boring out here. But when you get out there on a bike, it's so cool because, you know, you see these thunderstorms roll across the plains. There's like wild horses that when they see you, they like run towards you to basically say hi. There's pronghorns out there. The colors are really, really beautiful. Like, doing it by bike totally changed the landscape in my mind, which was really cool. And I kind of thought it was going to do that for the whole ride, but actually we had a little bit the opposite experience in Canada, where I was expecting central British Columbia to be kind of wild feeling, but it turns out it's just all logged. Like, it's like riding across Kansas or something, it's just like, it feels like a farm, but the logging industry, like everything has been cut down. They leave like a little bit of a buffer on the side of the road. But when you can see through that, or Taylor would take his drone up, you can see it's just all been cut down. And so that was, and then there's just logging trucks buzzing you all day long too. So there's a lot of surprises on the trip, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, kind of a surprise on the good side is just finding the beauty in a land that, you know, we kind of buzz by at 80 miles an hour sometimes, but then on the flip side, expecting raw wilderness and seeing, you know, heavily logged. And I have seen aerial photos. I don't know if they're from Taylor or just in maybe Nat Geo magazine or something like that, where it, when you're driving on a highway, it looks like it's just like dense forest, but then you pull above it and to your point, like it's just like this strip of trees along the road, but then it's all like gutted on the inside. And what an eerie kind of vista that was. Like when I saw that, I was like, oh my God. And it also seems pretty like dubious, you know, like, oh, we're just going to leave just the trees that people will see when they're in their cars so they don't freak out that we've logged all the trees. So yeah, I mean, I'm curious, like the main objective, of course, was to talk about and draw attention to Tongass, but were there environmental issues or achievements, you know, good or maybe challenging or troubling that you recognized before you got up to Tongass?
Yeah, I mean, so I met with the Enviro team in Patagonia and figured out all the places they were biking through that they've been involved in. So the Red Desert in southern Wyoming was one of them. They've done some work to try and like keep oil and gas development out of the Red, and mining development out of the Red Desert. We rode through the Red Desert. The, you know, we climbed Mount Hooker, which I wasn't really thinking of that as an environmental fight, but it is wilderness. And so I've thought a lot about that since, because of all the fixed anchors and wilderness issues going down there. Like Mount Hooker seems like a great example of a place where fixed anchors are kind of important, and we're thinking about what the future of that looks like. And then just right next to the Bugaboos in British Columbia is a Patagonia made a film about stopping a ski resort there. The film's called Jumbo Wild. So a whole area of really kind of magnificent wilderness that they were going to put a ski resort in. And really the environmental fight works there. It like hasn't happened, at least as of yet. And it seems like it's not really on the table anymore. But it was interesting going to the Bugaboos and being like, what if this was like Chamonix? What if there was a town here? What if there was lifts going to the top of all these mountains? Like, would that be cool? Would that not be cool? I don't know. It just made us think about that more. And then, yeah, going through central British Columbia, you know, we rode through all the national parks. Like we rode through Banff National Park and a couple other national parks. Like a huge part of sort of the path that we took was in national parks. And the national parks were pristine and beautiful, although a lot of them had burned. Like forest fires were a big part of our story. Like we were tracking them. There's a lot of forest fires last summer. We were really worried about whether we're going to have to change. At one point, we were going to completely divert and ride like an extra 800 miles or something to go around all these forest fires. And then rain came in and luckily they kind of calmed down. And so near Prince George, British Columbia, we were able to just go our original route. But, you know, a lot of British Columbia has either been logged or burned. Like going through British Columbia, I was like, man, the tree had a hard go of it. And we're going, you know, this trip really was conceived as this idea of like protecting forest, and then you're going through this mass area that everything's been destroyed, and so you're like, man, this is really important to protect the forest. We were listening to books as we rode, so we listened to this book called The Secret Life of Trees, and we were thinking a lot about the forest, which is cool.
Yeah, how interesting in that, just like how essentially smart trees are and how they'll communicate and how they'll even take care of trees that have been cut down. They'll keep sending nutrients towards them and all that. That book, like, I was just like, what is happening? Like, trees are so smart.
Yeah, that's cool you read that.
God, dude, I'm just like, there's so much to unpack here, and we can't dive into all of it, but I think that I want to shift towards talking about some of the climbing along the way, like in Mount Hooker, the Bugaboos, and then of course your experience on Devil's Thumb. But to wrap up a little bit on the biking portion here, for those of us who likely won't be able to do like a mega ride like that, I am still curious what you feel is accessible for those of us who are interested in having some sort of adventure like this and biking and climbing, and, you know, we're just accustomed to driving or we're accustomed to flying. What are some, you know, do you have any beta? Like you went from like being like total noob to you know, doing this pretty epic trip. Like, what are the main takeaways for those of us who might want to dabble in something like this?
I mean, I think all you need is time, which is hard to get, right? Like, that's, you know, you shouldn't undervalue that. Like, getting the time to do 2 months on a bike is not, most people can't do that. That is a place of privilege right there. But the act of biking across the country, like, we ran into quite a few people who like were on terrible bikes that they bought for like $100 and they were like biking all the way across the country and they just had like stuff cam strapped to their bikes. And like, you don't actually need much in the way of like financial resources to make that happen. You just like stop at gas stations and buy food and, you know, camp in ditches along the way. I mean, you can just make it happen. And I mean, part of the idea came because a bunch of my European friends are into this idea of green point. They call it green pointing, where they get to the crag without internal combustion engines, no airplanes, no cars. They take trains and bikes. And there's some awesome adventures that come out of that. And then this guy, this Patagonia ambassador, Seb, Sebastian America Day. Yeah. Yeah, he green pointed Yosemite, right? Like, he wanted to come climb the Don Wall. And so instead of flying, he found some people with a sailboat and he sailed across the ocean. And it was during COVID and they wouldn't let him dock in the United States. So he had to dock in Mexico and then bought a car for like a few hundred bucks and drove all the way across the country and spent, you know, a month and a half or 2 months trying to climb. By the time he got to Yosemite, it was like the middle of winter. And so he tried to climb the Don Wall through the winter. Luckily, it was a very dry winter and made a good go of it. And then had to reverse the whole thing home. And I'm like, man, the idea of like, I mean, he took what could just be flying over there and spending a month in Yosemite, turned it into this 6 month crazy adventure. And I'm like, this idea of greed pointing can just like expand the magnitude of the adventure incredibly. And I liked the idea of doing that. I was like, can I greenpoint Alaska by bike, you know, not even allow a car or anything, you know? And I guess Seb's thing was that he just didn't want to fly in an airplane. He used cars and stuff. So I was like, can I go all the way to Alaska just by human power by bike? And it was like, there was like the environmental story part of it, but more it was like using those guardrails to expand the adventure.
Yeah. Well, I remember, you know, the last time we spoke, when I was asking you about kind of what's the future of, you know, you pushing your limits and climbing or beyond, and you really expressed this passion for exploring the limits of human endurance and human ability and just adventure in general. And I think so much emphasis in the climbing community, and certainly I am guilty of propagating that with this show, in fact, is talking about pushing top end grades and who's going to do, you know, the next, who's going to do 516A and this kind of thing. But what I'm understanding from this experience and some others that you've done with Alex and, you know, down in Patagonia, et cetera, is that the adventure itself can be incredibly fulfilling beyond just whatever the climbing objective is. And do you feel yourself being drawn more to that, this more kind of like 360 degrees of adventure and pushing the limits and experiencing new challenges and that kind of thing, as opposed to one singular objective, like I want to get to the top of this thing?
Yeah, I'm being drawn to that more, partially just because I can't push the limit in the super like scientific, like, you know, by the numbers ways that I used to in some ways. But I also think like the overall ethos in climbing sort of like, it like vacillates between like, it's all about training and like performance. And then it like goes back the other direction there. It's all about lifestyle and adventure. And I feel like the past few years have been about like training and performance. And I feel like it's starting to go back the other way a little bit, in my mind, at least. Maybe that's just my own little world.
Yeah. What do you think of that?
I think that's a natural evolution. I think it's great. Yeah. I think it's really, and I try to do them both. Like right now I'm focused more on training and seeing if I can climb 9A as like a middle-aged dad. When we were in the Bugaboo, Sonny Trotter and Alex Honnold and myself kind of like made a bet. We're like, let's race to the ninth grade, see who can get there first. And so we're sort of dabbling in that world, but that's mostly just kind of like a fun game. I think really where my heart lies is like these big mega adventures right now.
Well, since you brought it up, I have to talk about that a little bit, because when I was out I went up to the Clear Light Cave with Alex when I was out in Vegas just recently, and I was flailing around on that 12A that, you know, maybe never send moment of clarity. The hardest 12A I've ever gotten on. And then Alex was working on, I think, what might ultimately become like this 9A objective, this kind of link up that he was doing up in that cave. And he mentioned this kind of gentleman's race between you guys and Sonny, who was also out there not too long ago. I think the three of you guys were out there, right? So
yeah.
What's the status? What's the update here? And if you were a betting man, who's going to hit 14D first?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't bet on myself. That's for sure. Alex, as with so many things in life, he's so like systematic about it. He chose his 9A like a long time ago. He's probably put 100+ days into it. He goes up there like 3 days a week. He plans his life around it. He's like really on the program. He's training for it, everything. Sonny and I are so much more loose with it. I think Alex is way closer. You know, we're both of us are like, well, maybe we'll finally pull it together like next fall or something. So that's the status. I mean, I've been training. It's been motivating me. I'm like kind of like firmly in mid 514 range now. Like I can climb mid 514. So I haven't been able to do that in a while. It's good to know I can get back there after, you know, being 2 years off with my Achilles and everything. But see if I can bump it up to, you know, 14+ by maybe this spring, but probably next fall. That's sort of where I am with it. I felt like my best, you know, when I started trying to figure out a good 9A for myself to climb, I was like, it should be close to home, because if I want my expeditions, my travel to be about adventure. So home can be more about like fitness. So I was like, I got to find a 9A that's close to home. Turns out there's no 9As on the Front Range of Colorado, which is so crazy. There's like 30 of them in Las Vegas, but there's one maybe that you do this boulder problem, this like V13 boulder problem in Clear Creek and link it into like a mid 513 route. That's the only 9A. And I was like, that seems kind of dumb. I'm going to have to find another one. So I found another one that I hope is going to be 9A. It's a route called Grand Ole Opry that I did as a teenager that was a 14B. That's, in my very biased opinion, one of the best sport climbs in Colorado. And then I figured out that you could do like this different start that adds like a 4+13 to the beginning of it, because it's on the side hill. So you just start farther down and right. And so I was like, if I'm going to win this race, it has to be a route that I already have dialed that I'm just adding a bit to. And I think it's going to be amazing.
It'll be an FA.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, 45 minutes from my house. I can drop my kids off at school and go do it and then pick them back up again.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, obviously this is, it's all relative. I'm never going to push into that grade myself, but I have heard others talk about how important it is to try to push your limits close to home so that when you go on trips, you can try and get some faster ascents and just enjoy yourself and, you know, taste the local flavors and that kind of thing. So that seems like a smart strategy. You mentioned you're training for it. Like, what does the training look like?
Well, it's funny. I think what I've ended up doing, like when I had my Achilles injury, I was like, I'm going to hire a trainer. I got on the Lattice training program. I tried to get stronger fingers than I've ever had. I tried to kind of follow the new school and do the scientific stuff. I started thinking about my diet more. I started tracking things. I was doing a lot of hangboarding. I was doing all that. And I didn't love it, honestly. And so now that I don't have an injury anymore, I'm just reverting back to what I did as a teenager. I'm climbing with my dad. I've been going out with my dad. I've been climbing close to home like I did when I was a teenager because I had to because I was in school. I've been climbing outside a fair amount, like 2 days a week all winter long. I go outside to sport and I just like try to kind of alternate hard bouldering, hard climbing on my woody at home, and then going sport climbing outside, and just like a lot of climbing.
We all have our flavor, right? But I think just like what you've always done is just climbed a lot. And
I think I've realized in retrospect that what I did as a teenager actually worked really well, you know? Like it was so fun, and it kind of brings me back. Like I really haven't focused on, I've done some sport climbing in the last 20 years, but I haven't had a period of, like, I'll do like a few days a year or something, but now I've been consistently sport climbing for like 2 months again for the first time in over 20 years, and it has been really fun.
Do you remember the last time you climbed a 9A sport pitch?
Oh man, I mean, The last time I climbed a 9/8 board pitch was probably at the Fortress of Solitude when I was like, you know, 22 years old. Flex Luther. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple pictures on the Dawn Wall that might be 9A, which are, you know, not really sport climbing. It feels like a very different sport up there. It's like such technical. Yeah, but even that was, you know, 2014. So that was 10 years ago. I did do an 8C plus in like 2000, sport route in Seyuz in like 2012, maybe. That was the last time I did kind of harder sport route. I went there on a trip with Jonathan Segrist to help him do biography. And while he was doing that, I managed to do a 8C plus. So that was the last time I, like, you know, spent a month sport climbing before this.
Well, man, we should get you over here to the Red River Gorge. There's, you know, there's Southern Smoke Direct, which I think, you know, could probably put together on a trip out here. Well, you were just out here not too long ago, actually. You're out here with Patagonia.
Yeah. Yeah. I came out there for 4 days or something, but I wasn't climbing. I was in my cast then.
That's right. That's right. Well, Chris Sharma was out here for just recently for the last Rocktoberfest, and I spent some time with him out when he was on the Golden Ticket, and Michaela Kirsch was on Pure Imagination. And it's another example, not to digress too much from the task at hand here, but you're talking about, like, you know, when you were younger and you were climbing a lot and that's what worked. Like, that's another one. You know, you look at Chris and, like, he just climbs, you know, he's working on LeBlanc now. He put down Sleeping Lion not too long ago. And, like, that dude, it seems like he's allergic to a hangboard, you know, he's just out there climbing. So I guess it's a lifestyle thing. If you have the capacity to get out and climb a lot, then you can essentially train through your climbing. Drew Ruana, you know, I talked with him recently, and he does 4 or 5 days a week of really hard bouldering there in Colorado. And essentially that's his training. You know, he's not spending a lot of time doing pull-ups.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I felt when I was a teenager. I think Chris actually brought that into my life. Before Chris, people were focused on competition climbing. They were looking at the Euros, at least in my world, and they were like kind of the more scientific period. And then Chris kind of blew that all up. He's just like, I'm just going to go climbing and have more fun than everybody else and just try really hard. And so there's a period of time where that's what we thought made you a good climber. And then I think the Olympics and everything kind of brought us back again to the science and the training. And that's why I said before, I think we're now maybe, at least in my mind, going back towards like just have a lot of fun and go out and try hard. And maybe that's the way. So I don't know. I mean, I think both ways work.
Well, dude, I mean, one thing that you've certainly done a lot of and that Alex does as well is get out and just do a lot of mileage. And not always is it pushing the limits, but it's a lot of moving over rock. And it'll be interesting to see this gentleman's race tonight. What's the wager? Is there
no wager? No. Nothing. Just like, this is going to be fun. I do this occasionally throughout my life, like little ski races, or, you know, I would, you know, I had a friend who I would do like workout classes, CrossFit workout classes. And then we would just email or text each other our, you know, our stats and compete that way. It's just a way to be like social and, you know, and like a very positive competitiveness that gets you psyched and gets you doing stuff. I really like to do that.
Right on. I love it. I love that you guys are doing that. All right, let's flash back now to the trip here. So you did some wicked climbing in Mount Hooker. It looked like you were on that, sort of like a grade six that Matt Siegel put up. Was that it?
Yeah, Matt Siegel and Jesse Huey put up an extraordinary route on Mount Hooker a few years ago. I'm blanking on the name of it. All Hooked Up is what it's called. They spent a bunch of time out there kind of establishing the route. And so we just got to, you know, bear the fruits of their labors, really, and go back and repeat that. It was really cold when we were there, though. That's one of the things about a bike ride. Like, you get there and you have to kind of climb it when you're there. And we, you know, and since we wanted to go all the way to Alaska that summer, we went kind of too early. We had to trudge through a lot of snow, climb it when it was really cold. So we did it easy. There's two variations. Like, Matt Siegel did a hard variation. We did an easier variation. But anyways, we spent 5 days in Mount Hooker, which it's interesting. Like, usually when you go to Mount Hooker, the idea of walking 15 miles into Mount Hooker feels kind of big, right? But after biking 100 miles a day to get there, we're like, 15 miles is like nothing. I mean, already, you know, just 4 days into our trip, we had kind of settled into this idea of just being active, moving, like, you know, 8 to 15 hours a day, day after day after day.
I mean, the the caloric burn must have been astronomical. Were you tracking that with your Coros? Do you know like what your deficit was each day, and how were you making up for it?
You know, I thought we would just have to pound food all day long, but since we biked slow, I think you don't bonk in the same way that you do if you're going fast. So we would just eat a massive breakfast, a pretty big lunch, and a massive dinner, and then I would eat like a, you know, just a few like Cliff shots or shot blocks, and you know, I'd eat maybe like four or five of those a day. So I did lose weight on the trip. Like I had gotten a little bit of a dad bod in my 2 years off of climbing, and it returned me back to being a total machine. Alex gained weight on the trip, believe it or not. He was bummed. Alex, we had a fun time together, but he struggled, I would say, because like his like morale is directly proportional to the amount of finger strength he has. And we were just on bikes too much. We would bike for like 4 hours. We'd do a hangboard workout and every day in his van in the middle of the day. And he could see his stats just like going down, and it really bothered him.
That's funny. So because he's been trying to level up to this 9A. So like he was keeping track of his finger fitness along the way.
Yeah, he just climbs so much and all the time, and he really is about being a great rock climber. Like, and for him, he felt like it was, you know, being on the bike and hiking so much was bad for his rock climbing. It was bad for his rock climbing. For me, I wasn't in great rock climbing shape anyways, because, you know, I had good hangboard stats, but I hadn't been climbing hard stuff in a long time. So it came at a good time in my life for that.
All right, just a quick breather here to ask you a really dumb question. Do you want to climb with one of the best sport climbers in the world? And do you want to take your projecting and nutrition game to the next level? Of course you do. What a dumb question. Now you can, y'all, with Jonathan Segrist and Shayna Savoy. I love them both so much. It just doesn't get cooler than this. Starting June 1st, Jonathan and Shayna are offering a 3-month climbing and nutrition program with Shared Air, custom made for a max of just 30 climbers. And check out what this program includes here. A masterclass on projecting with one of the best projectors in the game, 4 Zoom courses with J-Star on projecting, and 4 with Shayna on nutrition, an in-person clinic with both Jonathan and Shayna, and then also, get this, a dream climbing trip to 10 Sleep, where you're going to put all the learnings to practice with your new coaches / besties. What? And just for us strugglers, Shared Air is offering a $300 discount on the program, which shakes out to just $66 per month if you choose the monthly payment plan. That is cheaper than a gym membership. Let's go. If you are looking for a life-changing experience as a climber, this is it. Hit that link in your notes or pop over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/sharedair and use code STRUGGLE to get that $300 discount. Shared Air, where climbing lives. This episode is supported by Coros, a fitness watch that was made for climbers. Y'all, I've been using their Apex 2 Pro, which, by the way, you've probably seen on the wrists of guests Tommy Caldwell, Sasha DeJulian, and Stefano Gisolfi, just to name a few. And I'm telling you, it's really changed how I look at my training and my recovery. Honestly, it's just the best wearable tech on the market when it comes to supporting us climbers. A lot of the stuff out there has no idea how to handle climbers and what we do with our workouts. I mean, check this out. It has a feature that'll auto-detect the pitches that you're climbing in the gym or out on rock, and then you can log the grade of those. You can program all sorts of workouts in there, including hangboard workouts with timers built in. And then with all the biometrics that it analyzes, it's really helping me to optimize my training and my performance. So if you like to geek out over your training, and if you're busy like I am, I think Coros could be pretty revolutionary for you. You can hit that link in your notes or swing over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/Coros. And you can also, by the way, score yourself a free watch band with a purchase of an Apex 2 Pro using code STRUGGLE at checkout. Were you concerned about the technical level of the climbing that would be required for Devil's Thumb?
No, not really. We knew that the mountain was a big, you know, low angle trespile, basically. I mean, very beautiful mountain, but it was more of an adventure trip than it was like a sending hard climbs. Like I think for Alex and I, like, we're going to be able to climb 512, probably even into lower 513, kind of no matter what, just based on the amount of time we've spent on rock. And we knew that we could pick a route that wouldn't be harder than that.
Right. Okay, I got you. So the challenge of Devil's Thumb is more of an endurance challenge, kind of alpine style, getting to the top. I mean, maybe you could just describe kind of essentially you arrive in Alaska and then you've got to tackle this objective here. The film crew's out there. The idea is to get to the top of it, right? So what did that entail?
I mean, we knew Devil's Thumb was going to be just like a overall adventure. Like historically, people walked in from the ocean, which is like 20 miles. In the beginning, like back, you know, Fred Becky did this is what Krakauer did. But they'd walk up this big glacier that has now turned into this giant lake, like this iceberg filled lake. It's impassable now. So Nobody has hiked into the Devil's Thumb for a really long time. Now people helicopter in. And actually, one of our good friends, Colin Haley and Mikey Schaefer, climbed the Devil's Thumb like, I don't know, like 8 or 9 years ago. And they did, they linked like the entire range, the Diablo Traverse. And the way they did it is they just like lived in Seattle at the time. They checked the weather forecast. The weather got good. They flew up there. They helicoptered straight to the base of the mountain. They climbed it over 3 days and then they came home. You know, it was like a week long trip overall. It was just like this tiny little blip. It was just like one thing. It didn't make much of an impact on their lives. For us, biking all the way from Colorado and then pioneering this new approach in, I mean, this was like a major, it wasn't just like a little blip, you know, just because of the way that we went about it. This was like a pretty major thing for us. So in my mind, the magnitude, the adventure and the difficulty was really in the whole package. Like we had to bike all the way up there. Like the crux of the entire trip, like the entire 2 month trip was actually approaching the mountain, like bushwhacking through the forest up this valley that hadn't, I don't know if people had ever been completely through this thing. Like people had been up the bottom part of it and people had flown into a lake near the top of it and gone into the mountain. But I don't think anybody had ever like bushwhacked up this entire thing. So we were pioneering this new approach and it was gnarly. Like Alaska bushwhacking is real deal. I think there was a 2 day period where we were going about a quarter mile an hour.
And you're like literally bushwhacking, like you're talking like machetes to create trails.
Yeah. Yeah. Machetes. There is this like steep river with like class 5 rapids the whole way. And then and near the bottom, there's this insane salmon run going up it where you could literally just reach into the river and grab like 2 foot long, big long salmon out of the river. There was thousands of fish that had been eaten by bears, like fish eggs and guts. Just it smelled terrible everywhere, like so much bear activity. But we had a big crew, so we saw one ear of a bear one time, but we didn't. And I think they just heard us coming and they fled the other way. But the bush, I mean, it was such thick brush that you could, a lot of times you couldn't even touch the ground and you couldn't go in the river because it was too fast. We had 11 person crew at that point because that's when the whole Nat Geo thing kicked in. And so we had Renan Ozturk with us. We had producers. We almost lost one of the producers when we were bushwhacking on this incredibly steep hillside right above these cliffs above that like dropped off several hundred feet into class 5 rapids. And at one point, one of the producers like slid through the forest and like stopped right on the edge of this cliff. And they would have died for sure if they would have gone into the rapids. So that was like the scariest and hardest part of the whole trip.
Just getting to the climb.
Yeah.
It's just wild. You don't even think about, I mean, because you intentionally eschewed the helicopter ride, you essentially brought on this like super harrowing approach that you hadn't been considering. And what kind of state did that put you all in when you then did get to the base of the Devil's Thumb?
I mean, we were so used to the labor that it takes to get to these things that, I mean, we just knew we could get pretty beat up and then just get an okay night's sleep and wake up and be okay the next day. I mean, we got to the mountain and luckily the world's best weather window that's ever been seen in that part of Alaska arrived right as we got to the mountain. Like the sky's cleared for 9 days, which is totally unheard of. And so we had this hard time going through the forest, but then we eventually came out of the forest into the alpine and we did really good after that. Like we were in our element. We went fast. We got through the glacier to get up to the climb super easily. We climbed the whole Diablo Traverse in like a day. Like the mountain in the end was just a really small part of it. And that was interesting too, because like I said, this is one of the most dangerous mountains in the world by numbers. And Krakauer's experience was totally harrowing, and Becky's experience was incredibly harrowing. And they talk about this incredibly alpine mountain, you know, covered in snow and ice. And, you know, I was expecting both of us to be sort of out of our comfort zone in terms of the alpineness of the mountain. But in the last 20 years, it's just melted out. It's just a rock climb now. So Alex and I are really good at rock climbing. We're not very good alpine climbers. So when we got to the mountain, it was just such a small part of the whole thing. Although, I mean, it was incredibly beautiful. Like the mountain, the surroundings were the most menacing I've ever seen. Like big ice falls collapsing, just all this like roaring going on all the time. The mountains are so pointy, like it was straight out of the Lord of the Rings or something. It was such a crazy place. But the climbing itself, like we just know how to do that.
Right. Yeah. And what an interesting kind of dissonance between this idea of you guys are rock climbers, and so it suited you well. It was, you know, good that it wasn't heavy alpine, but yet the reason that it's not is because of climate change, right? I mean, that's the reason the glacier is now a lake, and the reason you are climbing rocks instead of ice is because of the warming planet, which is part of the, you know, the reason that you were there for the trip. But I just like to hold these concepts that are kind of at odds. It just must have been a pretty wild feeling.
Yeah, I mean, we're constantly thinking about how climate change is affecting these places. And there it's drastic. I mean, the glacier's totally changed, the mountain's totally changed. There's a face on the Devil's Thumb that's actually the biggest alpine face in North America, the northwest face of the Devil's Thumb. It's never been climbed. People have been talking about how it's probably not even climbable, like it's completely unclimbable. There's been like 5 or 6 deaths of people trying to climb that face. And you know, they say that it's not climbable because the conditions are so different from it's a 7,000 foot face. So from the bottom of the face to the top of the face, the temperatures are so different that they're like, you could never get it in condition the whole way. There's always going to be part of it that's like falling apart. But then we got to it and we looked down it and we're like, it's just totally dry now. Like it's very chossy, but it almost seemed like somebody could go and free solo it in like a few hours. It didn't even seem, I mean, it seemed, and using a rope on it might be more dangerous because it is very chossy, but you could imagine somebody just like tiptoeing up the talus for a few hours and just free soloing the whole thing. Like, I don't think it's unclimbable by any means.
God, who comes to mind on the person who might?
Yeah, Alex looked at it. He's like, it doesn't even appeal to me really because it's just a giant chossy face. Like the only thing that appeals is sort of like the lore behind it.
A 7,000 foot choss pile does not sound like the most fun to climb for a few hours, but
yeah. And maybe Alex would have been into that kind of thing, but I'm, you know, it's still going to be dangerous. Like it has to be somebody that is really, really willing to really stick their neck out there. And I'm not really willing to do that at this point in my life. And Alex is more, but he's even at a place right now where he doesn't, you know, he's got, you know, baby on the way. He's like, doesn't want to do that either. So you need some young person who doesn't have much to live for, and they'll be able to go and crank that face out in a few hours.
Well, yeah. Did that subject matter come up with you two as dads, as, now, you know, being kind of in the master's chapter of your careers as climbing, as you were looking at this adventure or others that you have planned, how much do you talk about risk and consequences, and how has that evolved over the years?
Yeah, we talk about that. But on this trip, we felt like the difficulties were in the endurance and the suffering for months on end, not in the danger. You know, biking is a little bit dangerous, but, you know, that's well within our comfort zone. Bushwhacking, you know, you're probably going to be okay bushwhacking. The Devil's Thumb itself was just way safer. Like, I think going into the trip, I was like, oh, I'm, you know, it's a pretty dangerous mountain historically. But we had talked to Mikey about it, and he's like, I think it's not that dangerous, really. So we had sort of done enough research that mostly myself, but also Alex, felt like the danger wasn't a huge part of it. Now, the Nat Geo film might totally take a different angle. Like, they love danger. I'm sure they're going to play up the danger side of it. But in terms of what we've done in the past, like, I think a lot of my outings with Alex are much more dangerous than this experience was. And I think we both have such a high need for like adventure, and you can get that through the danger, or you can get that through suffering. And I think we're just both veering towards suffering. Like, we need the adventure, but we don't want to die.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes sense now with a longer lens and obviously more to live for. When you do look back on some of those earlier adventures, younger, dumber Tommy, younger, dumber Alex, what stands out as maybe pushing it a little bit close to the envelope?
You know, it's so hard to know. Like, I've had experiences where I felt like I was close to death a few times in climbing, but it's usually been because something kind of random went wrong. Not that the objective was overall super dangerous. The one exception to that is maybe speed climbing the nose. Mm. That was quite dangerous, I think. And I just at that time convinced myself that if we went about it carefully enough, I mean, you can kind of make it really safe if you go slow and you place a lot of gear. So I knew that there was like this sliding scale. But then it turns out when we got excited about it and we're trying to go faster and faster, you just start putting in less gear and bringing less gear and taking more risks. And you feel comfortable. And so you allow yourself to push those limits. And in the moment, it felt fine. But in retrospect, I'm like, you know, for me, that was maybe a little bit more dangerous than what I probably should be doing.
Was it calculated when you were doing that, in as much like you were aware of how run out your placements were, but you felt the climbing was controlled enough, or were you aware that it was pushing it?
I mean, you had to go into the free solo mentality, which is something I sort of don't. I don't free solo kind of on principle, and because it would terrify my family. But I'm pretty good at getting into that mindset. If you're just placing one or two pieces of gear pitch, you just have to really trust that you're holding onto the wall well. And so you climb the route every day and you just get really used to the climbing and you build that confidence up. And you analyze the falls and, you know, you bring a lot of logic into it that makes it safer. But it's interesting, when we did this, when we sped climbed the nose, we climbed it like, I don't know, set like 8 or 9 times. And we're like, oh, I feel like we're being safe. We're kind of going slowish and just slowly ramping up. But then 2 guys died speed climbing. And then you rethink it all and you're like, maybe we're just being ignorant. You know, we've seen that with base jumping. A lot, all the Yosemite climbers or a lot of them got into base jumping. And when you would talk to them, they'd be like, oh, we're just being careful. We're making sure that we're packing our chutes right. We're analyzing everything and it's not all that dangerous. And then they all die. And so you wonder about that with speed climbing a little bit sometimes too.
Well, and you took like a massive winger, like was it like 70, 80 feet or something like that?
Probably like over 100 feet.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then you came back and then you still went. So taking that kind of fall and like you messed your ankle up, right?
No, I didn't. I didn't hurt myself. I mean, I've taken 100-foot falls like multiple times on El Cap, and that's the beauty of that wall. It's sheer, right? And so I think honestly, taking 100-foot fall is within my risk tolerance level on El Cap.
Okay, so something like that doesn't shake you. You're just accustomed to it at that point in time. I would quit climbing forever.
I don't know if it doesn't shake me at all, but it's interesting when it happens. Like, I remember when I took a 100-foot fall on the nose, I literally, like, my immediate reaction wasn't fear. It was just like, but I like hit myself in the forehead. I was like, stupid. Like, how could I let myself do that? And I just jumped on the wall and was back up in like 2 minutes to where I had fallen from.
It's such a far fall. You have time to think. When I fall, like I'm at the end of the rope, you know, I get scared. I'm like, I'm gripped. I know I'm coming off and like I have all this time to think before I let go. But the second I let go or come off, like I'm already at the bottom of the rope. When you're falling 100 feet, you're like you got some time to put some thought into that fall.
Yeah. I mean, I think you sit there and you think about how scary that would be. And for me, when I take a giant fall like that, I'm like, oh, that was actually less scary than my mind made it out to be.
Well, so similar to my falls, just on a much, much greater scale. it's really exciting to see the evolution of your climbing. We're talking about El Cap right now, and you were out there not too long ago with Alex again. And I think you guys both made some posts along the lines of, wow, climbing El Cap feels a lot harder now than it has. We're feeling a little bit of, you know, a little rust or something. Maybe it's because you just hadn't been in that style in a while, or is it a fitness thing? I'm curious what it was like returning to this, you know, this place where you've put up incredible FAs and done more than anybody else has on that piece of rock there in the Big Ditch. So
yeah,
back on that most recent trip on the face of El Cap, what was that?
Yeah, so Alex wanted to climb the Heart Route, which is a route that Mason Earl and Brad Goldbright put up. Mm-hmm. And I'm just always in for a good adventure in Yosemite with Alex. And I hadn't big wall climbed in years, right? And Alex had been doing it a little bit less. Like, he had been adventuring more and sport climbing a lot. And I think when we got to Yosemite this year, I mean, Alex did amazing. Like, from my perspective, he is just getting better and better. Like, he's so good. But he talked about feeling a little bit less in tune with, like, Yosemite big walling this trip. But that could be partially because he was dragging me up the mountain. I hadn't big wall climbed in a long time, and I just figured I could just have it. And I think the experience was a lot harder for me than it would have been 20 years ago or 10 years ago, partially just because I needed to get back in shape for that type of climbing. Like, hangboarding with a broken Achilles doesn't really get you in shape for El Cap. It turns out you need to just get up there and climb on El Cap more. And I needed more endurance. Like, I'd been doing some bouldering, but it turns out there were some really pumpy pitches. And the experience was great up there, but I definitely came out of it being like, man, I don't think it's age necessarily that is making this harder. I think it's more that age leads to busyness, and busyness makes that kind of thing harder. And so if I want to get good at it, I'm going to have to somehow carve out more time in my life again to dedicate towards that type of climbing. Like, the reason that Alex and I have gotten so good in Yosemite and at moving over a rock efficiently is just because we spent so much time doing it. I mean, we spent decades of our lives like just doing that basically. And neither of us have really been in that place that much in the last few years. So Alex succeeded. He did great. I didn't quite pull off the climb. It was interesting. Like, I guess I'll talk about this. There's this weird thing this evolution in ethics in Yosemite, where like we used to always, you know, this is how I climbed the Don Wall and everything. Like, red pointing a pitch was about starting at the bottom of the pitch and climbing to the top without falling. Right. And so that's how we've always done it. And we've wrapped it, you know, beyond that, we'll wrap in, we'll do whatever. But the Euros have brought this, they kind of changed it a little bit. They brought this ethic of going ground up, which seems really badass, right? Like, they start at the bottom and they don't wrap in to the climbs anymore. But I realized this year that actually they've changed a different ethic, though, where they don't climb from the bottom to the top of the pitch. They just go from stance to stance. And if they fall in the middle of the pitch, they just lower down to the last, like, no hand stance, and then they continue on. And so we were climbing with some other Euros up there, and I was like, should I do this? Like, I was falling on one of the crux pitches, and I was like, should I just go down to the last stance? And then I could definitely send this pitch this way, and then therefore the route. And so I did that at one point, and then I got a few pitches higher, and I was like, nope, that's not good enough for me. And so after that, I kind of gave up on the rest of the climb. I couldn't have Alex wait for me anymore.
Wow. I mean, just the ethics of it. I'm glad you brought it up, because I think also, as you were talking about this gentleman's race to 9A, you were talking about new school ethics around some tactics that are used from kind of the younger generation that's coming up with various tips and tricks and tools that they're all using to optimize, you know, different conditions and this kind of thing. But then now, like, the ethic also that you're talking about on El Cap, what do you make of it?
I think it's just something that ebbs and flows, like ethical things. Like, when I first started climbing El Cap, we would just red point the pitches and then we would come back. Like, when I did Lurking Fear still doesn't have a continuous ascent from bottom to top without coming to the ground. Like, we spent a month like trying to climb this, like the fifth and the sixth and the seventh pitch, and we just wrap down and we take a week rest or whatever, and then we'd go back up and then we just continue on. And then the ethic changed and got stricter for a while, that now to do a route that you have to start at the bottom and get to the top in a continuous push. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like this ethical thing is just another one of those. They just vacillate and they change over time, and it's all fine. You know, it's like whatever formats the best possible experience and makes you feel good about what you did is totally fine in my book. As long as it doesn't change the experience for other people and doesn't change the rock.
Being out there, you said big walling is you know, it's a commitment. It's a mindset. It's something that you really have to commit your body and your lifestyle to. What do you foresee in terms of big walls in your future?
The psych is still high, for sure. I wish I could do it all the time. But I can't. Like, the motivation has never been my problem. It's just choosing which adventure to pursue and making enough time for it. Yeah, and I honestly don't know, like, where I'm going to take it in the future. Like, right now, I really like these big adventures, like biking, you know, like green pointing things and getting creative with that sounds pretty awesome. I like the idea of going on these massive big adventures, doing like one a year, one every 2 years, and then just, you know, sport climbing and bouldering with my friends and family in the meantime. I kind of think that's where I am. Right now, I'm not at a place, and I don't know if I ever will be again, where I feel like I have to best myself. Like, I don't feel like I have to do anything bigger and better. I don't feel pressure. Like, I would be open to that if it seemed like something presented itself, but I'm not like anxiously looking for it the way that I did a lot when I was younger.
That's a pretty mature perspective. Does it sit well with you?
Yeah, I think it sits mostly well. I mean, I think partially because my life is so much more diverse now. Like, there's so many awesome things going on. Like, I've got this incredible family and I want to be with my kids and I want to like make this great life for them. And, you know, I got my environmental work and I do a lot of design work and I, you know, I've gotten into writing sometimes and bits of film production. And there's like so many things that kind of fill me up emotionally that I've got involved in that it doesn't all ride on sending anymore. And in some ways I do miss the simplicity of just going out and being able to just climb. But I also appreciate that there's more things that can sort of like bring me fulfillment now. And I think that's as a middle-aged, you know, climber, I think if it was all about sending, you know, that would just lead to sadness at some point when you just can't do it anymore.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that perspective. Everybody who's listening to this right now is going to get older at some point in time. And so we think about our age and where will our place be within this sport. And
yeah, but I don't want to take anything away from people that are pushing the number grades higher and the technical difficulties. Like, I admire that. I cheer them on with everything I have. You know, I'm trying to climb 9A again because I love that battle that brings to your life. And so, yeah, I just like that I'm at a point where it doesn't feel like everything to me anymore to do that. But the people that do, like the people that have that incredible fire, I think that's very exciting.
Yeah, me too. Well, no doubt you are capable of pushing your lifetime achievements higher if the right thing comes around, like you said, if you get struck by it. And I'm drawn to these words that you wrote in a post, I think, as you wrapped up this adventure to the Devil's Thumb. And you said, on a personal level, this has been an incredible journey of friendship and elective hardship. But in a broader sense, it's been about finding our role in protecting nature and becoming better stewards of our planet. And I'd like for you to just maybe expand on that a little bit as we wrap up this Earth Day special here. You went on this epic adventure, but there's something much bigger that sparked the idea and I think that you discovered along the way. So what were those takeaways?
I mean, it really was motivated by trying to understand what I can do and what Alex can do to be better stewards of the Earth, because we're both kind of environmentalists in certain ways. And
big ways.
Yeah, in big ways. And getting really close to nature, like getting in it and just being super immersed in sort of the most intense way you can imagine, like having it all over us every day, was really magical. I loved that. And I think if you want to protect a place, you really need to love it. And so that was kind of the goal of the trip for me in a lot of ways. At least that was the starting goal. But then at the end of the day, you know, nature is great, but like the people is really what it's all about. And so doing it with Alex was so special. And I feel really, really lucky to have him as a friend and have gone on all these incredible trips with him. And I hope we keep doing them.
I love it. Thank you so much. I'm so hyped as an Earth Day special goes, just the through line of advocacy and awareness and just connecting with nature. Like you said, like, it's hard to protect something if you don't know it and love it intimately. And I think that's what came through on this conversation. So I really appreciate the time and the passion and also all the work that you're doing, Tommy.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you, Ryan. I'm so psyched you're doing the Earth Day special and I'm honored to be part of it.
Yeah. And let's give that as like kind of a final shout out here. You're aware of a lot of organizations and advocates that are working out there. There's a lot of issues. There's no shortage, right? It can almost become overwhelming if you like take a huge look. So can you give a shout out to maybe a couple or you know, a small handful of organizations that you feel are doing great work? And if we have disposable income or we have time to volunteer, that they might be good ones to take a look at.
I mean, I always try and like make sure that I'm giving to like a big national organization and then kind of a mid-sized one and then a small local one. And so I think you should always find that. One great tool Patagonia has is the ActionWorks website, or the ActionWorks platform, where you can go on their website, Patagonia ActionWorks, and just type in your zip code and it tells you about all the environmental nonprofits that they support. There's zillions of them. And so you can find out about what's local to you. And that not only gives you an opportunity to give to them, but it also can get you involved in a community of people that are like-minded and want to do good things for the earth. Right now for me, I've been doing so much work in Alaska, and so much of that is informed by the Alaska Wilderness League. So that's kind of that's maybe like a mid-sized one that I support. The smaller one that I like is that I invested in right now is the Honnold Foundation, because it's Alex's, that's an awesome one. And then like the Wilderness Society is a, you know, kind of a big one that I think does a lot of great work. So
with regard to your main objective, which was to raise awareness for the Tongass, the beauty of the Tongass, but also the need to protect it, what can we do if we want to try to support your efforts there?
You know, I've been trying to nail that one down. There's an incredible, probably the most inspiring activist, young activist that I've ever met is this girl, Marina Anderson, who's like an indigenous activist from Tongass. We spent 4 days with her we actually sailed the Inside Passage in Alaska, as making our way to the Devil's Thumb. We rode our bikes to the coast, and then we sailed for almost a week to get to the actually where we started hiking into the forest. And we stopped for a few days and learned about the forest from Marina Anderson. But it's like a whole acronym soup of different organizations trying to protect the Tongass. But I think if you like follow Marina Anderson on Instagram or something, you're going to really get a good idea of the best ways to do that.
All right, that clips the anchors on this special Earth Day episode with the one and only Tommy Caldwell. Man, if you are not properly hyped up to plan a big adventure right now, well, I guess just go back and listen to this thing again, and that should do the trick. I just personally love how Tommy is allowing his career and his passion and his overall relationship with climbing to evolve as he gets older. And I think he's got some pretty epic objectives that are going to blow our minds still to come. Now, if you want even more Tommy and who the heck doesn't, I just dropped a bonus episode for patrons and Apple subscribers where Tommy shares his thoughts on how to improve as a granite climber, his most fun, scariest, and funniest moments adventuring with Alex Honnold, some really fun stuff came out of that one, what he feels could be the next Dawn Wall and who he thinks might be able to tackle it, his view on retro bolting on El Cap and other classic climbs, and so much more. You can get instant access to all of that right now at zero cost with a free trial over at patreon.com/thestruggleclimbingshow or right there in your Apple Podcast app if you're an iPhone person. And you'll also, by the way, get instant access to more than 40 hours of other bonus content featuring Adam Andra, Chris Sharma, Nina Williams, Alex Honnold, and so many more, plus the pro clinics that we've done on Stronger Fingers with Dr. Tyler Nelson, Advanced Bouldering with Allison Vest, Moonboard with Ravioli Biceps, and Performance Hacks with Hazel Finlay, just to name a few. It's all there for just a few bucks a month or zero cost right now with a free trial, so you can check it out. Thank you so much for supporting the show if you can. I'm working really hard for you here.
huge thanks and appreciation to our show sponsors who have brought you this episode at zero cost. Check your show notes for links and special discounts from those guys that are only available to Struggle listeners. And also, you can see all of the show's brand sponsors and special deals by just popping over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/deals. The Struggle is carbon neutral in partnership with the Honnold Foundation. Awesome. This episode was produced and hosted by me, Ryan Devlin, and The Struggle is a proud member of the Plugtone Audio Collective, a diverse group of the best, most impactful podcasts in the outdoor industry. You can follow along with the show on YouTube and Instagram at The Struggle Climbing Show, and you can also shoot me a note there. I'd love to hear from you. I hope training and climbing are going awesome, and if you're struggling like me, well, at least The Struggle makes us stronger.